Well, now we're on the 8th verse of the 10th chapter, and things begin to happen that have a familiar ring here. Now, they, 10 and 8, yeah. They try again here. They try again. He said, I despise him. Remember, Laman is watchful. Lamoni doesn't miss a thing. So this attack doesn't go so well. But notice the situation. Notice how they do it. He has his spies watching. He's been burned once, you see. They came out from the north of the land of Shimon, armed with bows and arrows, swords and scimitars. They had their heads shaved, and they were naked, and they were girdled around with leather girdle about their loins. You notice the standard equipment here? The leather clothing and the wild hairdo, they're like a motorcycle gang, aren't they? The same thing. No, they had the equipment, the leather and the, and notice they had their heads shaved and they were naked except for the leather garments they had on. And they're trying to inspire terror, of course, and this is a very important thing. Dressing up is an essential part of soldiering. In any other line, it would be considered overdoing it, but you have to distinguish rank, you have to distinguish superiority, and the whole idea of the dressing up and all this nonsense, this is just a regular exaggeration, not exaggeration necessarily, a necessary part of the uniform, as we read from Clausewitz, because the purpose of the military is, of course, to break the enemy's wills, not to destroy them. These people don't want to, the Lamanites don't want to destroy the Nephites, they want them to work for them. That's the whole thing, they want to enslave them. There's no point to destroying them, and that's exactly what Clausewitz teaches the Generalstab. This was the textbook for World War I, you see. And the important thing is to break the enemy's will. When he does what you want, that's all you want. The war is won then. There's no point to body count at all. It's utter absurdity. It makes no sense, as the great Clausewitz said. That's the standard work on war, as you know, from Krieger from Clausewitz. And so you want to discourage him and make him lose heart, so you make yourself look as terrible as you can when you approach. That will break his spirit sometimes, you see, if you look very awful, and they thought it would work, as far as this goes. So this is part of it. The posture of dominance requires this high profile and distinct superiority. You have to be able to distinguish rank at a distance, of course, in armies, and that is, of course, why you have the banners and the trumpets. The banners are to distinguish particular units and so forth. They all go back to the steppes of Asia. Won't go into this, but you get more of this in the story of Ether here, the Book of Ether, but we'll get to that. But I say their objective was to put the Nephites to work and not to destroy them, and it's more than that. Well, of course, intimidation is the quickest and easiest way of dominance. You try that, see if it'll work. And it still goes on. This was part of the policy of the general staff, and they actually adopted it, Schrecklichkeit, and Hitler adopted it too. Schrecklichkeit means terror, making yourself as terrible as possible. And they did. That was the idea of the Blitzkrieg. Be absolutely overpowering, absolutely merciless, strike, and intimidate right from the very first. They look terrible, you sound terrible, you threaten and all this sort of thing. So that's what these people are doing. They do it all through the Book of Mormon. And it works, when the people are wicked and feel guilty and that sort of thing. And so it's all out here. It's the worst possible case we see in the 9th verse. Extreme danger for the Nephites. It requires full mobilization of every bit of manpower they can possibly get. And the women and children are taken off and hidden in the wilderness. Which follows a pattern too, hiding them in the wilderness, taking them out of sight and so forth. This happens likewise. You can put them on ships, or you can put them in the Sietch. That's islands when the barbarians invade, there's special places where they go and hide, certain woods and so forth. And you see a lot of this sort of thing. At a place called Vagel in Holland, where we were stuck, there was this huge huge storage, a grain elevator and so forth, with this vast area underneath. And all the people of the three towns around were all the women and children were down there. That's where they were, the whole thing. And so that's where we set up headquarters. I was stuck there for 2 weeks without being able to pop your nose out. But let's get them out of sight, and that was what was done. And they're mobilized, we're told, and organized according to the pattern of Israel, as we read in the Milcomus scroll, the battle scroll, by age. It's the easiest, the most obvious, and the most natural and workable way. People of the same age groups working together and so forth. So that's what he did. Ranks every man according to his age. And so they went up to battle against the Lamanites, And they went up in the strength of the Lord, and then we have this interesting thing. The odds were with the Lamanites. As to the strength of men, now this is an important thing. Peace through strength, as to the strength of men. Of course, we have a marvelous discourse on that in the, I'm very tempted to go into it, that's why I brought it along. In the very first chapter, the opening of the Doctrine and Covenants, section one of the Doctrine and Covenants, it deals with this problem very, very much to the point, right down the line. First of all, we have an exposition of a situation here in verse 17, and things are bad, you see. I, the Lord, knowing, verse 17, section 1, knowing the calamity which should come upon the inhabitants of the earth. He knows what it is. In the 35th verse, he says what it is. Time is not now, but is near at hand, when peace shall be taken away from the earth. The devil have control of his own dominion. I, the Lord, knowing that, have taken certain steps. And notice what perfectly rational steps they are. What do we do about it? He says, first of all, he called on one man, as he always does. You notice this. Therefore, knowing the calamity which should come upon the inhabitants of the earth, called upon my servant Joseph Smith, Jr., and spake unto him from heaven, and gave him commandments. Just one man in this case, as it's always been. Noah was the only man. Abraham was the only man. Moses was the only man. Forth, and the prophets. And the knowledge is handled down from... It's shared by all of them, as we read in Moroni 29:32. We won't go into that now. But he lets others in on the information, too. Notice the 18th verse, the next verse. Also gave commandments to others. They proclaim these things that spread the news around and get this going, you see. This is the 18th verse. Others, that they might be involved in this, that might be fulfilled, which is written by the prophets. And the ones he summons for this work are not the ambitious or the powerful ones. He mentions weakness repeatedly. He only takes them on when they are weak, as notice he talks about here. The weak things of the world shall come forth and break down the mighty and strong, that man should not counsel his fellow man, neither put trust in the arm of flesh. Don't you tell everybody what to do and back it up with force, which is exactly what everybody's doing today. And then he says this should not happen. He has what our best defense would be. Well, what about Adam? Remember? First book of Moses, first chapter, Adam, weak, helpless, now I know that man is nothing, which thing I never has supposed. It took him hours to get his strength again. He was weak, he was as weak as a baby, lying as if he were dead on the earth there. And he finally began to stir as weak, and that's when the devil struck. Satan chose that time to attack, when Adam was at his weakest. And it was the same thing with Enoch. I am but a lad, and the people hate me. I am slow of speech. He had no qualifications whatever when the Lord chose him. And the same thing with Moses, who was also slow of speech, and Aaron had to be chosen to do his speaking for him. And you'll go down with the prophets, I'm not the prophet nor the son of a prophet, and so forth. And of course, Jesus, despised, rejected, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief, a more lowly beginning than the manger could not be imagined, and so forth. And, well, after all, Joseph Smith, we have his story the same way. So he begins with the weak ones because they're the ones that will listen. But that every man, faith must have, everyone must have his own testimony. And the first, notice the next verse, the first point is faith. Faith is our best defense. This, it's very interesting how Brother Kimball brought it out here. He says, few men have ever knowingly and deliberately chosen to reject God and his blessings. Rather, we learn from the scriptures that because of the exercise of faith has always appeared to be more difficult than relying on the things more immediately at hand, making yourself look terrible and so forth. Carnal man has tended to transfer his trust in God to material things. We'll be the strongest. We have the most nukes and so forth. He says, therefore, in all ages, when men have fallen under the power of Satan and lost the faith, they have put in its place hope in the arm of flesh. He's quoting here from the Doctrine and Covenants, you see, in the arm of flesh. And this is what's happened here. So, he goes on here and tells us here about ourselves. Enoch, too, was a man of great faith who would not be distracted from the duties by the enemy as the enemy. So great was the faith of Enoch that he led the people and their enemies to battle, the people of God, when their enemies came to battle against them. They were on the defensive. And then you say, what are we to fear when the Lord is with us? Can we not take the Lord at his word and exercise a particle of faith in him? Our assignment is affirmative to forsake the things of the world as ends in themselves, to leave off idolatry and press forward in faith, carrying the gospel to our enemies that there might no longer be our enemies. And that was the mission of Ammon in the Book of Mormon. We get to him. He was a great man. Well, anyway, this is, the faith is the next thing that's required in our first section here. Then the next verse, the 22nd, then this is the covenant. We enter into the covenant and so forth. Again, it is, notice the weak. We enter the covenant that the weak and simple to the ends of the world will testify before kings and rulers. And the next verse, it talks about weakness. Behold, I am God, and have spoken these commandments are of me. They are given to my servants in their weakness. You have to qualify by being weak. Where is your peace through strength? And that sort of thing, you see. Then he explains how he can make us much stronger. The only safe defense you have is this, and it's the perfect defense, of course. He goes into this. It's in three things. We find in Moses 7:32, he gave Adam all three things to defend him. And they are these things that follow next. Now, imagine yourself if you were wired, idiotically like I am here, but you were wired to receive messages. You're out on a patrol, see? And you're in a terribly dangerous situation. It's desperate. And unless you can get through here, the division is sunk because we don't know what side they're going to hit us on. You're in very dangerous. It's night and so forth. But you're wired up and you can receive messages from somebody who's not in a Piper Cub observing for artillery. He's in a spy satellite that has magnificent electronic devices such as they do today. They can read an inscription on a dime through a dense fog, anything like that. He's up there and he can see everything. Well, you're safe then. He can tell you the three things the Lord says he's going to do. First, he says, he will give you knowledge. He says to Adam, in the Garden of Eden, I gave him knowledge. Well, that's a good thing to have what's going on. But even what I know what's going on, what do we do about it then? This is the worst thing. You see, the commanders, they get all the information, but they want to throw it away. They say, we'll just go in and plunge ahead with a formal, we never turn back, we never bother about this, we'll go in and show them, and then he gets in the soup. But the knowledge, and then you have to have instructions, advice about you. That's what you ask for. He says, I gave knowledge, and I gave him commandments, and he says, what were the three things? He said, I gave him knowledge, and I gave him, instruction. And then when they go wrong, you give him correction. That's what it says here. Of course, it puts it this way. That, notice, inasmuch as they, in their weakness, according to their language, inasmuch as they sought wisdom, they might be instructed to what to do. First of all, they received knowledge. Notice, if they are humble, there's your weakness again, they might be blessed, made strong, and receive knowledge from time to time. And then with that, you receive instruction, and finally, you, even obeying the instructions, you make mistakes, you always blunder, you go the wrong way, that inasmuch as they've erred, it might be made known. He tells you when you're making mistakes. So you have information, you have advice, and you have correction. And you have it from one who knows everything. If you follow that, you're perfectly safe. But what does everybody do? What would you do as a patrolian? What does the commanding officer do? He turns off the receiver. He says, we know what's happening down here. I know the situation best. We'll hit him right now. And I say he loses his shirt. And this has happened quite a few times. You'd be surprised. So he says, I've given them everything here. And this is how he helps the Nephites out. He says, if they're weak, I'll give them knowledge. And then, he tells us finally in the 30th, at the end in the Doctrine and Covenants here in the 30th verse, he tells us that it is specifically the church through which we receive this information. That's where we get our message conveyed. Through the church, we receive the knowledge and the instruction and the correction to act together and know what we're doing. You see, so we have to cooperate, and that's what the church is there for. Get these things going together. Well, and next, this is followed very interestingly by, it works here, the strong people as to the strength of men. And they were, from 12th to 17th verse, he gives a very fair and honest and unbiased presentation of the Lamanite case. The Lamanites have a case too, you see. They have a reason. They feel offended. They feel threatened. Look, they see the Nephite power building up. Remember, it says that the king started to get worried. King Laman started to get worried when he saw the Nephites getting too strong, and that's why they began to make trouble for them. And then he stirred up his people to make trouble so that they'd do something about it. Well, here, It says they're wild and ferocious and a bloodthirsty people. But they firmly believed that they'd been driven out of Jerusalem because of the iniquities of their fathers, and they were wronged in the wilderness. They blamed Nephi for everything. That tells us why the terrible pressure Nephi is under that you get at the end of the book of Nephi, his discouragement, his absolute desperation. He's pressed all the time. He's held responsible for everything. They say Nephi was to blame for it all. And they firmly believe that because they were taught that by their fathers, and they need to teach it to their children. The basic thing, see, Clausewitz also says, all wars are defensive. You're always just defending. You never attack. He says that's the first rule, you see. So the German staff changed themselves from Kriegsschule and Kriegsamt, from the war office and war school, to Wehrmacht, the defense power, see, the defense forces. And we changed ours until World War II. We would call it the Secretary of the Army, Secretary of the Navy, and Secretary of War. There was, in World War I, there was Baker was his name. He became Secretary of War. We changed that, Secretary of Defense. Now we're just defensive. We never make wars anymore. Everything is defense. We took that hint from the Germans. You change it to Wehrmacht, the defense forces, and our forces, from becoming the War Department, becomes the Department of Defense, of various things. Well, and that's what they do here. Then it's very important, you see. That's necessary for morale and for justification and everything else. And, of course, they understand this. And they've been wronged, and they go on. And this, that they were wronged in the land, their first inheritance. And you notice then, the author here puts in parentheses here, the real explanation of what it was. When they had crossed the sea, and they were robbed of their first inheritance when they crossed the sea. And he says, all this was because Nephi, just because Nephi was more faithful. That's where what their real beef was about. Nephi was more faithful in keeping the commandments of the Lord. Therefore, he was favored of the Lord, for the Lord heard his prayers and answered them, and he took the lead of their journey in the wilderness. And this is what they resented. And his brethren were wroth at him, because they understood not the dealings of the Lord, and also were wroth with him, poor Nephi, upon the waters. They tied him up, you remember, because they hardened their hearts against the Lord. And again, they were wroth with him when they had arrived in the promised land, because they said he had taken the ruling of the people out of their hands. See, we was robbed. So that's when, brother, what's his name, asked the last time, why does he say that they would go against them? It wasn't to revenge, was it? The objection to it was that they had been betrayed. The Nephites had betrayed them, you see, because they were the real ones in charge. They had taken away their birthright, their right to rule. This was built up, you see. It's the very same thing that you build up, the French and the Germans, for hundreds of years, built up a case against each other. They raided us. They burned our castles. They said that on both sides of the line. And this went on for hundreds of years. I had a war. The French and the Germans are finally beginning to see that's not going to pay off, that sort of thing. But that was the big thing in Europe for centuries, as you know. The two divisions of the Frankish people. So we've taken the ruling out of their hands. We ought to rule. See, it's our right, and you've robbed us of our right. Well, that's what the Shiites say. See, the Shiites believe that Ali, the nephew of Muhammad, should be the head, and the Sunnites believe that Omar, his uncle, should be the head of Islam. And that's what all the fighting's been about. And if they're still in bloody war, it's not safe anywhere in Lebanon today, because the Shiites, they're both devoted, passionate Muslims. But just to this idea, was it Ali or was it Omar, all the fight's about. This goes on. It's so absurd, these fights that continue, these feuds. And they were wroth with him because he broke off and left them. They said he shouldn't have done that. Well, that was betrayal. That was treason, you see. How these things get worked up, you see. He parted into the wilderness and had commanded him, just because he departed into the wilderness, and what's more, he took the plates of brass. He robbed us of our inheritance. They had no interest in those plates, but like a thief, what did they care about the plates? Until he took them, you see. And thus they taught their children. They built this in. So, really, if you were a Lamanite, you'd have a good case. You could argue, you could pound the table and make your case very clear that Nephi took all of it. He was the younger son. He had no right to those things. The other brethren went along, etc., etc. You'd build up a big argument. They taught their children that they should hate them, they should murder them, they should perfectly clear and plunder them to get their birthright back, do all they could to destroy them. Therefore, there was an eternal hatred toward the children of Nephi. Now we see those feuds in the world smoldering for many generations everywhere. Of course, Ireland is a classic example. Ever since 1620, there's been no peace. The other side's always been guilty. It's been going on. My grandmother left Ireland when she was 17 years old. She says she never wanted to go back. All she could remember in Belfast was blood running in the gutters, and that was a long time ago, and they're still doing that sort of thing. It's an awful thing. But these things go on and on and on in the Philippines. Of course, there's the Moriscos and the Christians of the Philippines. They go on forever and ever. And, of course, in Palestine, it's just endless, you see, the Jews and the Arabs, and the Arabs and the Arabs, and the Sunnites and the Shiites and so forth. So this is the world we live in, these perpetual feuds. And they do hang on for, well, after 150 years, they're still digging up the same old stuff about the Mormons. They're still just as bitter as ever. And you find the people that write about this feel personally robbed by Joseph Smith. Joseph Smith has robbed them. You find the great resentment against those people, and I correspond with them more than anybody, I think, these anti-Mormon groups and so forth. They feel a personal, bitter resentment against Joseph Smith. He's the one to blame for all this. Poor little old Joseph there. I mean, just a farm kid trying to do his best and so forth. And 150 years later, big, powerful institutions blame him for something or other. I don't know. But they hold him personally responsible. But I say the Lamanites had a case by it. It was the national myth. We see in the 17th verse here, they taught their children that and handed down to the little ones. What could they do but accept it? And this eternal hatred. And then what do we have here? And the IRA syndrome in Ireland, as I see, the Palestinians, the Jukes and the Kallikaks in America. You know, the feuds in the South, they're ancient. Well, the North and the South, they were never going to stop until this bloody settlement. And, of course, it was still going on when I was in grammar school. We were still fighting the Civil War. The only songs we ever sang in class were Civil War songs, marching through Georgia and all that thing. They're costly and exhausting, these fumes. They're permanent, they're simplistic, set policy between parties, as in Latin America, to destabilize and disrupt. That's their idea. Notice they did all they could to destroy them. That was the solution. They didn't just leave them alone and hate. They tried to destroy them in this eternal hatred. They tried to destabilize them, undermine them, strike them wherever they could, and keep a constant pressure on them. These policies we see. This should all be over with after two world wars. We should have learned something about this sort of thing now. Instead, it gets worse. And that's why we have the Book of Mormon, why we're warned. I should have mentioned there, remember, where the Lord says in that first chapter, in the 17th verse, therefore, knowing the calamities about to come upon the children of men, I called unto my servant Joseph Smith from heaven and gave him commandments and gave him the Book of Mormon. This is a special handbook for these particular dismal times. Well, King Laman set his trap and bided his time all these years. He was going to have a notice his craftiness. He'd got them in. His fair promises deceived me. I have brought this, my people, up into this land today that they may destroy them. Yea, we have suffered the many years in these lands. All these years, this is smoldered now. And so Zenith roused them up, stimulated them to go to battle. If you must fight, see, he did. And it came to pass, they slew them with great slaughter. And they returned again to our own land and began to tend and till their flocks, right back to square one again, which is an interesting thing, you notice. All wars in the Book of Mormon take place on Nephite territory, except the last one, where we're told in Mormon 4 and 4, where he says, if it had not been that our people went up against the Lamanites, they could not have defeated us. But as soon as they did that, he said, I knew the jig was up, because that wasn't so. And then the next verse he says, don't worry about the wicked neighbors you have and so forth. Behold, the justice of God will overtake the wicked, and it is by the wicked that the wicked are punished. If you feel you must punish them, you'll get right into it yourself. It is by the wicked that the wicked are punished. At an early phase of the Korean War, it was announced by our general staff that the North Koreans were virtually beaten, but they hadn't been sufficiently punished, so they decided to continue the war. Because they hadn't been punished. It is by the wicked that the wicked are punished, remember. The Lord repeatedly says in the Book of Mormon, vengeance is mine, I will repay. Well, at the end, of course, that's climactic up there. Well, we go on here, but it's already at this time, you see. And so then we have the next chapter. Zenith is not a man of very good judgment. You notice he's done foolish things, this Zenith. In Mosiah 9 and 3, we remember he got into trouble with the leader of the crew. He wanted to make peace. He wasn't too tactful about it, and he was responsible partly for the breaking up of that. Then he went back and led, soon after, he insisted on leading another expedition, and it was poorly equipped, and they suffered from hunger and thirst. They had a terrible time because they weren't properly prepared. And now he gives the kingdom a son who, it shows at best he doesn't have good judgment, because the son was a rotter, see? But this is the most interesting thing now. His judgment wasn't the best, but we overlook the fact that the wicked Noah was an extremely popular king. He was the most popular king in the Book of Mormon. We say he was wicked, a terrible Noah, and we look at pictures drawn by Arnold Freeberg, and we say, ooh, what a fiend he was. But he wasn't that way at all. But he was very popular, I say. But notice, it says, when it talks about abominable here, that's a Kerethan Kathiv it uses. Do that which was abominable. Kerethan Kathiv is when you use one word to cover another word, a particularly displeasing word. Kerethan Kathiv, a good example of that, is the hemorrhoids in the Bible. Hemorrhoids, that's not nice. So they use the correct, they use a totally different word for it as far as that goes. And where it's used here, abominable means kinky sex, and whoredoms in the plural, saying all kinds of depravities. This is the idea. And what's more, we read that the people went along with it. He caused the people to commit. They joined him in it. He did cause the people to commit sin and do that which was abominable. It wasn't just in his court that were doing it. It spread. He set an example that was followed. He gave him whoredoms and all manner of wickedness. That covers a lot, you see, of Azar, Kereth, and Kathib. That's right, Afar. They use for emeralds, they use the word Afar, which just means dust. It's a complete cover-up. We'd never guess what it meant, you see, from that. But the same thing, these cover a lot of vices, you can be sure. And he laid a tax of 1/5. Now, that was the perfectly normal tax, 20% in all ancient societies, the 20% silver tax. Babylonian, Egyptian, everywhere. And it was not oppressive. You could really prosper with it. But, of course, it was what it was used for. It was the waste it was put to. That's the next verse tells us that. He did it all to support himself. And it was a whole new ballgame, a new culture. Notice, he changed the whole plan of society. It was talk about a new administration, he says here, and also his priests. Thus he changed the affairs of the kingdom. He completely changed the whole thing. He put in new personnel all the way, his wives and his concubines and his priests and their wives and their concubines. Remember, it was a sacral state. It was a priest state. They were the governor. He was the priest king, and they were the priestly governors, and they were the highest court of law, and he changed the whole personnel. He swept it with a broom, a clean sweep, and he put down all the priests that had been consecrated by his father. You see, he removed all the priests that were in there and consecrated new ones to suit his own, fancy, such as were lifted up in the pride of their hearts. Well, their pride, they were going to take over. They're really going to do things now, the kinds of things they're going to do. It is a sacral state, we see. Completely replaced the administration. Mm-hmm. Zenith was the son of Mosiah, you see. Not Mosiah, but he was the third, wasn't he? They led them out. What was it, three Zeniths? Who was it now? Well, he had it. They came out of Jerusalem, and Mosiah was in charge. He got it from Mosiah, and Mosiah had his way back from the beginning, you see. He was Nephi, too, and he had it from Nephi. So Nephi has it. It comes that through that line. These migrations. Imagine Joseph writing all this out, like all these migrations. He never gets mixed up. I get mixed up all the time. But he's writing this just cold, you know, no notes, no references, no evidence of any study, no handbooks or sources available anywhere, and he produced this. Quite a trick. And complete. Well, I think of other administrations like Alexander the Sixth Borgia and so forth. Roderick Borgia, he was a Spaniard who became Pope. And he put his son, the famous Caesar Borgia, in charge. And it was just such an orgy. And it was with the power was completely in Italy, was completely in the hands of those people. And it was divided between the scrupulous and bloody use of power and vast immorality, and all sorts of ingenious devices for misbehaving. So we're getting that sort of order of things now. And the people joined him in the idolatry, because they also became idolaters. Notice, the people labored exceedingly to support his iniquity. Now, the fact that they worked hard doesn't sanctify their wealth or the uses of it. Remember, we're told way back, Jacob says, you've worked hard, and the Lord has rewarded by your industry. You've acquired great wealth, and it's vile. You shouldn't have it. You see, this is it. The fact that you worked for the stuff doesn't mean that it's sanctified at all. And here, the people were all in for the program. They were great. He was a very popular king. He put on a great show. The people labored exceedingly to support the iniquity and also became idolatrous because They were deceived by the vain and flattering words. He told them what they wanted to hear. They joined in it. He was won over by the official rhetoric, the flattering, which the public loves to hear, of course. Speak flattering things to them. And they liked this business. They joined with Noah in his excesses, too. You read in the 15th verse, he became a wine bibber, and also his people. They joined him in all this thing. And, of course, the elegant and spacious buildings, they're the things we're proud of. They're the things that make the civilization. They're very showy and so forth, and magnificent, and all the work in the metal and so forth. And this reminds us, of the vase paintings. Recently, just within the year, they discovered in Peru this great Mocha grave, you know, the greatest unplundered grave so far. That's in the 4th century. This is the 2nd century B.C., 500 or 600 years after this. Well, that's close enough, but the lavishness. Well, you see it, on the wall paintings and on the vase paintings and so forth. Everything is overdone, the heavy, massive. Oh, the feathers, the plumes, the jewels, the necklaces, the bracelets. They're just crusted with the stuff. And in the vulgar excess all over the place, just too much. This is characteristic of this civilization. The Book of Mormon complains of it all the way through. They're costly apparel. It's not beautiful necessarily, but it's costly, and that's the main thing about it. And he built him a palace on the throne. He got great public support on that, too, because we're proud of that. We're proud of our king and so forth. I may have mentioned C. Northcote Parkinson, inventor of Parkinson's Law, wrote a very good essay on the building of the great buildings in the world. Always the great, magnificent, marvelous show buildings come right as the last gasp of a civilization, just on the verge of collapse. They build these tremendous buildings. He shows this happens every time. I refer you to the contemporary issue of the National Geographic, which is on the skyscrapers of New York. It is almost sickening. I mean, these enormous skyscrapers going up 100 stories right next door to each other with no airspace in between them, just for show, and the way it boasts about them and so forth. It's really astonishing. Where can we go from there, you see? What would happen? I mean, they're not practical. How can people get out of those all at once? I mean, here you have 100,000 people right next to each other in one little narrow street between them. How do they all get out in 10 minutes? This sort of thing is not going to happen. But the palace and the throne, but these are legitimate appurtenances of civilization, of course. Architecture, building, the temple, of course. Anciently, they all put it all in on the temple. This was the big thing. And we're told that in the Greek and in the Roman orations, too. In ancient times, the people were proud of the temple and their sacred buildings and so forth. Now it's all in the private houses, they say, and the poor old temple goes neglected. You get that in Aristophanes and others. But the palace and the throne in the midst thereof, all of which was of fine wood, ornamented with gold and silver and precious things, and all manner of fine work in the walls of the temple, and fine wood and copper and brass. He's pouring it on because that's the way it was. And here's a nice touch of irony here. There's real satire in this one here. We think of Matthew 6 and 2. Well, the Lord puts a touch of irony and humor in there, too. There's more than you think in the Bible and the Book of Mormon. He talks about the rich men going to give alms. They must go to give alms. It's so generous. So they have a trumpet sounding before them to tell them that he's giving alms to the poor. Well, that's utterly ridiculous, of course, and it's meant to be. And this is, too, notice. Here he built these seats ornamented with pure gold, with this breastwork built before them, that they might rest their bodies and their arms upon this while they should speak lying and vain words to the people. Yes. They speak these things, lying and vain words, to the people. But it was magnificent. It was impressive, the people, that they sit there in their majesty and speak to the people. You know what they speak to them. And this brings up a very interesting parallel. But anyway, we go on here. And here, the tower culture, yes?
Wasn't it the practice primarily of the Nephites to construct their buildings out of wood rather than cement?
That's true. That when it was only built in cement when they found a place that had been deforested. Deforestation was very important there. It's the thing the Book of Mormon takes a good jump on, a good leap on, too. Though in the 17th, 18th century, deforestation was a great concern of scholars. They worried about that because anciently, once those forests go, they never come back again. Well, this one he's talking about here, he talks about very interesting stuff. He built a tower near the temple. One thing we all remember, of course, from Central American visits, pictures, and so forth, is that it's a tower culture. Towers, spotting the jungle towers everywhere you go. And this is, he built a tower near the temple, very high tower, even so high he could stand upon the top thereof and overlook the land of Shilom, the high land, and the land of Shemlon, which was the east, which was possessed by the Lamanites, and he could even look over all the land round about. Well, those of you who have been to Palenque knows exactly that's the setting. Incidentally, the tradition of the Hopis is they came from there, from Palenque. It's a very interesting thing. But the Parrot clan, you see, is the main clan. That's the mother clan. And the let's not get sidetracked onto that. But the towers are very interesting here. They have both the round and the square towers. There are two civilizations anciently around the Mediterranean. They coexist. There is the Pyrgos. Pyrgos, like Pergamon and so forth. That's your square tower, which is on a high, safe place. The city like that, the square tower. And so we get the words like, burg. Any safe high place is a burg. A burg or a burrow, as we spell it. Or berg, the German berg, it's a mountain. Heidelberg or Nuremberg. Or you have the word burrow, a hole in the ground. Well, it's a place of retreat, a safe place. But it's the Pyrgos, is the square tower. And you find the square tower people all over. And the Greeks always the Greek word for tower is Pyrgos, completely unknown to the Latin, which is the other word, which is turris, which means round tower. The Latin word is turris in the feminine. And all the Celtic people that came down from the north, they had the round towers. And so our word turris, our word tower, means a round or circle. And it's door we got this one here. It's door in Semitic language, meaning a tower, a round tower. The oldest city in the world, it has, the main feature is that huge round tower in Jericho. This huge tower that goes back, they say, as far as 8,000 years ago, they say, at least. So this, but it's a round tower. So you have the turris, the tower, and our word tour, of course, means to go around in a circle. All these things are very rich in things. Tour, turn, and as against Pyrgos, Berg, Burrow. What other bergs do we have? Bergen means to protect and so forth. So they have both kinds in South America, though. Came both Mediterranean types. You'll find both types. But the round top types are astronomical towers. That's a different thing, you see. The normal thing is square. Chichen Itza has both, as you know. But the round ones are for the stars. But they build these towers. And you can stand on that high, that Palenque, you see, not only that magnificent tomb, but up there there's that high tower that's on a high place. And you can go to the top. And it was meant as a watchtower. And you can see the whole land. You can see all clear down to the Hermosa there on the coast. It's all flat. Other towers you can see sticking up here and there. And you can see everything from this tower. Because it's on, all of a sudden the hills rise up, the mountains rise up, heavy jungle on it, magnificent trees. And here are these big towers right up there. And you can go up and just see everything from them. That was the purpose of it. Why would you bother to build a tower if you're going to build it lower down just for the symbol of the tower? No, you want to see as much as you can. Those were watchtowers at Palenque. You've all seen pictures of them. I guess we should show slides and things like that. But I find people, I never forget, never remember what I see in slides and the like. And so it came to pass, yes, he built many buildings and a great tower. This is a super on the hill north of Chimlin. You can be sure that was a great square tower, a great defensive tower. And thus he did do with the riches, like 4th century civilization. It was flashy, superficial, very impressive, and it's magnificent, but it collapses very quick. So what do we get? What do you need? And in this security, they lived the lifestyle of the rich and famous here. No, he placed his heart upon riches. He spent his time in riotous living with his wives and his concubines, and also did his priests spend their time with harlots. They had a high old time here, it is confirmed. And he planted a vineyard. Oh, this is an important thing, too. He planted a vineyards round about in the land, and he built wine presses and made wine in abundance, and therefore he became a wine bibber and also his people. See, he brings them along with him. Now, wine is native to America, as you know. You know where Vinland is, Martha's Vineyard and so forth. In the year 986, Bjarni Herjulfsson was a merchant who, along with Eric the Red, coasted along the coast of Labrador and New England. He came down as far as Massachusetts and reported grapes around there, and they went back. And then exactly in the year 1000, which is easy to remember, his son, Eric the Red, Ericsson, Leif Ericsson, he was Eric, Eric's son, Leifer Ericsson would be his son. He visited the coast and came back with a lot of grapes. And then another merchant followed in about No, it was, yeah, 1002, just 2 years after there. And they stayed, he took 160 people with him in three ships, and they lived there some. That was the usual thing, the big fight. They had the big squabble, and they broke up and went back again. But the land was rich in grapes here, and who else do we have? Well, that's about it. Well, the Skraelings, the Eskimos, they did away with them. The colony disappeared after a while. But the point is that they called it Vinland, and they were good grapes. Grapes are native to America. But they could have been planted by other people, as far as that goes, because this is a very important thing they're finding today. There's very little in the way of forestry. The whole phase, geographical face of the earth now, is the result of man's work, to a far greater degree than we ever supposed, including even things like the Sahara Desert, vast as it is, the result of our monkeying around. Well, then what happens here? Came to pass, now look, in this security, this is the way they're acting. So against this rich and apparently strong kingdom, the Lamanites adopt a policy of terrorism, infiltration. But it's terrorism. It's not banditry. Banditry is just stealing and so forth. Bandits can be good-natured, can even be friendly. Pirates and so forth, Bernard Shaw's Captain Brassbound's conversion and things like that, you know, stories about the good-natured bandits, or the good-natured bandits of southern Italy and so forth. But this isn't the thing. These people are animated by hatred and by a policy. They're real terrorists, in other words. They think they're idealists, as it tells us here. King Noah, it came to pass, did come upon them in small numbers to slay them in their fields while they were tending their flocks. And then it says in the next verse, they began to destroy and to exercise their hatred upon them. See, they were motivated. They were real terrorists, motivated to exercise their hatred. Remember, they have the case. They're just freedom fighters for their particular cause and so forth. And this is terrorism. It is not, I say, just banditry. They didn't just come in to rob them. And they killed many and drove off their flocks out of the land, and thus the Lamanites began to destroy them, to exercise their hatred upon them. That's a very bad thing, this terrorism. And they become bolder then. They infiltrate in mass, and the army gives them an unexpected setback. Noah got his troops together, and they were driven back, and they got overconfident, you see. They'd been getting away with this, and they were driven back. They drove them back for a time. Therefore, they returned rejoicing in the spoil. See, with that easy victory, surprised and elated by their performance, they suddenly find themselves standing tall. They very much pleased with the game. This is fun. They begin to enjoy it. The author deplores the situation. He holds the administration responsible. He says, well, what's wrong with victory? He says here, notice, because of this great victory, they were lifted up in the pride of their hearts. Well, why not? You see, what is wrong with victory? They were enjoying the shedding of blood. Having the upper hand, it tells us that here, you see. Of their brethren, notice the Lamanites are their brethren. They shouldn't do that, even with the bad Lamanites. Always, you see, and Moroni never refers to the Lamanites as anything but their brethren. And they shouldn't have done that. They were lifted up in the pride of their hearts. They did boast of their own strength, saying, 50 of ours can stand against 1,000 Lamanites any day. Thus they did boast and delight in blood and the shedding of blood because of their brethren, because of the wickedness of the king and his priests. Would he be responsible for that? I wonder whether to go into this parallel or not. Well, to get on here anyway. Now we get the story of Abinadi, and this is has a most striking parallel. You talk about recurrent scenarios. There's nothing more striking than this story of Abinadi with the story we have of the 167 right here, the teacher of righteousness in the Dead Sea Scrolls. This story, we told his story, is Abinadi's story. At the same time, it just happened about 2nd century B.C. the same way. And we find it in the Damascus Fragment, the Manual of Discipline, the Habakkuk Scroll, and the Thanksgiving Hymns from Qumran. So it's well documented, both of them. And they both go through the same routine. This idea, Mosiah, that they might rest their bodies while they should speak lying things to the people and so forth. And the IQH says, but they did lead my people astray, speaking smooth things, practitioners of vain rhetoric, melitze remuia, common form of lying speakers and vain seers, they're called, false prophet, melitze kazab, uchose remuia. And in their insolence, they would sit in judgment on the, and from the mouths of lying prophets led astray the people. See, just like these people with it. And they did delight, Mosiah says, they did delight in shedding the blood of their brethren because of the wickedness of the king and priest. And the Damascus fragment says, and they took offensive against the life of the righteous, took offensive, the offensive against the Yahudu, against the life of the righteous, and all who walked uprightly, and they hated in their hearts and pursued them with the sword and rejoiced in controversy. And they were wroth with him, and they sought to take away his life. This is Abinadi. But the Lord delivered them out of his hands. This is the 26th verse when you get here. And the Hodiotsko, where he's giving his autobiography, says, the ruthless ones sought my life. The gang of no-goods, the Soth Shaveh bums. The conspiracy of Belial. They knew not that my security was in thee, and they thought through thy mercy is my soul, and that through thy mercy is my soul delivered. They sought to take away my life and shed my blood, but thou, God, hast helped the weak and the suffering out of the hand of the one who is stronger than he. And Abinadi has said, the king says, Abinadi has said these things that he might stir up my people to anger one with another and to raise contentions among my people. Therefore I will slay him. The IQH, the prophet says, I became a man of controversy, an Ish-Reeve, a troublemaker, it means, to the preachers of error. And Joseph Smith says, I was destined to prove a disturber of Satan's realm, and a disturber and annoyer of Satan's kingdom. After the space of 2 years, Abinadi came among them in disguise that they knew him not, and began to prophesy. He says, for they drove me out of my land, and like a bird from my nest, and all my friends and relatives, they turned against me. Well, then he talks about his disguise and all the rest of it. But it's rather interesting here, isn't it? Here he comes. Well, let me see what we have here now. Abinadi comes into the picture, and the God will not acknowledge here, he says in the 22nd verse, yes. He's a jealous God. He will not acknowledge the excuse of worldly temptation. Granted you're tempted and so forth, you can't use that as an excuse, because he knows you're strong enough to resist. And their status as God's people is past, and it's now a liability and not an immunity. Now, the early Christians, as we read in the Apostolic Fathers, are the seven earliest writers after the New Testament of the Apostolic Fathers. And especially in Clement, who writes 1st and 2nd Clement, and in Ignatius, well, in all of them, as a matter of fact, you find this theme. They think, because they're members of the church, that God has invested so much in them so far that he can't possibly go back on them now. They are safe. We're safe home because we're members of the church and it's established and so forth. Because that's the most dangerous thing you can do. Because he says, the greater the security you feel, the greater the danger you're in. And then the apostolic fathers would cite, for if the angels kept not their first estate, were cast out, what do you think will happen to you? You think just because you feel secure because you've been blessed, but for that reason you're more responsible. You're in greater danger than anybody else. I say, can't you see that? It's your never safe home. Once you've got their blessings, you're stuck with something, and you're under double obligation. It shall come to pass that except this people repent and turn to God, it shall be brought into bondage. And he says, I will suffer them that they be smitten by their enemies. I will allow this all to happen, you see. And he says, even prayer won't do. The time comes when there's a time of no return, he says, and I will not hear their prayers, neither will I deliver them out of their afflictions. Once the shooting starts, that's that. It's too late then, you see. And he says, you've got to remember that. And the people didn't like that. They were very much upset by that. They were wroth with him. They sought to take away his life. And Noah was in a rage. He says, by what authority does this usurper, this upstart, speak? 27th verse. He's called a troublemaker and a subversive. He's stirring up my people to contentions, just making trouble. That's all it is. The more corrupt a government is, of course, the more zealous it is for law and order. It has to be, make a show of that. And they failed to see Abinadi's point completely. The eyes of the people were blinded, he says. They didn't see his point, the real evil, and they were determined to root out the protester, to fire the whistleblower. He was the one that was guilty, you see, which is the state. The people were blinded. They hardened their hearts against Abinadi. They sought to take his life from that forward, time forward. And then time is about up, though. We come to this interesting thing. He enters among them in disguise, and he appears among them saying, thus saith the Lord hath commanded me, saying, Abinadi, go and prophesy. Well, some disguise if he says Abinadi. No, that's not it. He says, and I should take it back to Dead Sea Scroll. He says he was only able to enter into the town that way. They would have stopped him long before. They would have stopped him at the gates. He was in their midst when he cast off the disguise. It says here, came to pass that after a space of 2 years, he came among them in disguise. intimate. They knew him not, and he began to prophesy. Well, you see the same thing in the Old Testament, in the New Testament, when Jesus goes in disguise to the Passover so that they don't know him. The prophets go in disguise. Saul is in disguise when he visits the witch of Endor and so forth. And disguising is very common, as Isaiah. Well, they go and hide themselves. Elijah hid by ravens fed. And they hide and they disguise and they circulate among the people and they're hid by the people in their houses. That's the normal career with prophets. He tells us how he went and lived among the fishing people and then went out into the desert for a while and then came back. But to get into the town, of course, he's disguised. But when he's in there, then he casts off, he's going to preach to them as Abinadi, and it hits them like a bolt of lightning, you see, and they get more trouble. Yes, you find in 1 Kings here and in John 11:54, where the Lord is disguised. So Abinadi comes back and begins to prophesy and really gets things stirred up. Well, I see the time is up now, so we'll start with Abinadi's sermon. And incidentally, these chapters from 15 and 6 is a long sermon. See, this is one of the most important doctrinal parts of the Book of Mormon. And chapters 15 and 16 are probably the hardest chapters in the Book of Mormon. Yeah. He's a tremendous teacher now, Abinadi turns out to be. And he's a nobody until we get to Samuel the Lamanite. He's even more offensive.